It's Monday, September 10th, 2012. I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And from WJCT Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, this is Deemable Tech, tech worth talking about. We're here to make tech simple, easy, and approachable.
Hey, got a question for us? Give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or you can send us an email at questions@deemable.com. Ray, you know, I've got this friend who actually applied to join the CIA after he graduated college.
Did he get in?
Well, he said he didn't.
Tom, what do you mean he said he didn't?
Well, here's the thing. I've been thinking. If he did get in, wouldn't he have to tell all his friends that he didn't get in? It's a catch-22.
Wow, that's kind of paranoid there.
It's not paranoia if they're really out to get you, Ray. One of my close friends could be a super secret spy, and I can't take chances.
Okay, so what are you doing?
All right, well, step one is to, like, you know, make sure all my personal information is safe and secure. So I've been changing my passwords. I've installed monitoring programs to watch for unauthorized changes on my laptop and phone. I've been backing up all my files offline. And I also make sure never to take the same way home from work twice.
Wow. Okay, first off, you really are crazy. But second, I think you're onto something here. It's always a good idea to take extra care with your personal information, even if one of your friends isn't a super secret spy.
He totally is.
It's a great idea to secure your data against things like hackers and spammers and unscrupulous corporations and so on.
Yeah, them too.
Yeah, so maybe we should walk through some steps people can give to give their personal information that extra layer of protection.
Okay, that sounds really good. Should we start by talking about how you should teach yourself to dream about heavily armed security guards so that people can't hack into your mind Inception style?
Maybe let's start with passwords.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so how do you pick an uncrackable password?
All right, password length matters. Now, if a hacker, imagine a scenario where a hacker is doing the simplest thing they could do to crack your password, which is running a program that just tries to guess every possible combination of letters and numbers.
Right.
Okay. Every single character you add to that password exponentially increases the amount of time it takes that brute force program to crack the password.
Okay.
So longer is better, but...
So we're looking at, we need like a 50-character password, or...
50 is pretty extreme. I think that would take longer than the lifespan of the universe to crack.
Oh.
But 12 is good.
I probably wouldn't remember it either.
Yeah.
So 12 is good.
But here's the trick. You don't want to use common words in your passwords, especially not words that are obviously related, because hackers don't just use the brute force method anymore. What they do is they have dictionaries of commonly used passwords. In fact... there's been several high-profile leaks recently where hackers got into, I think, LinkedIn. I'm sure there are some other sites. And basically, like, they stole huge lists of passwords. So they actually have dictionaries of real passwords that people use.
Like password.
Yes. And they also know...
The best password of all. Password.
And they also know about your little trick where instead of putting an E, you put a 3 in your password.
Oh.
You know? So basically, they've created programs that go through these dictionaries and guess the most likely passwords first. So what you want to do is you want to have a long password, like 10 or 12 characters, and have it be as random as possible. And if possible, you should use a different password on every single website or service you use, because... One of those websites gets compromised and somebody gets your long uncrackable password, then it doesn't matter anyways.
Okay, but if you're using a different password on every single site, that's going to get pretty hard to remember.
I'm still working on that.
Well, there are some programs you can use to remember all those uncrackable passwords.
Really?
There's LastPass, which is a web extension. You can add it to Chrome and Firefox. And it's free.
Pretty cool.
There is a pay option for mobile devices like the iPhone and the Android devices.
Okay, so it works on mobile too, though.
Yeah.
Because that's important. I do a lot of surfing online through my phone now.
When I used to have my Palm back in the day, I had a program that was kept on the device. And actually, it was sad because my Palm crashed and I lost all my passwords. But what's nice about LastPass is that it backs up to the cloud. So it's real secure. And you can access it anywhere, but also if you lose it on one device, that doesn't mean you lose your passwords.
Yeah,
and that's important. It just means you lose it on that device and you back it up later. So there's also another program called KeePass. It's a KeePass, and that is open source. It's a program that you download for, I think, Windows, and I think it's on Mac as well.
Okay.
And it's another good one too. So,
okay, cool. Another great idea, which I really like, is having a secret email account.
And I'm seeing that you like secrets.
I do. But the point of this one is to back up your main email account. You know, almost every service you use online says, hey, give us an email address so that if you forget your password, you can use this address to reset your password.
Right. We talked about that on a previous episode. That's how Matt Honan's...
That's right. Matt Honan, the journalist, he got hacked. And part of the problem was he had a Gmail account and he had a Mac account, and they backed each other up.
Right.
The resets were the other account. So what you need is a third email account. If Matt had had some, you know, account that he only used for doing the resets for Gmail and for his Mac account, he would have been in the clear. But the fact that his two main email accounts were the resets for each other, that's where he got into trouble. So having a third account, which you only use because you don't want to get this account out in the world, really, for anyone to know about. You don't want to have that address out on the web somewhere.
Oh, that makes sense.
Which you only use for password resets is actually a really great idea.
Hmm. Okay. What about, I've heard a lot about two-factor authentication. What's that about?
Right. We did talk about that pretty in-depth on a previous episode, so I won't rehash the whole thing. But basically, the idea with two-factor authentication is, in addition to a password to get into a website or a service, there's also going to be a second factor. Basically, usually what it is they're going to send a message to your phone, either through a text message or a call. So let's say I log into my Google account from a new computer. Google detects, hey, this isn't the computer that Tom usually uses.
Right.
So I'm going to send a six-digit code to his phone, and he's going to have to enter that into this computer to make sure that this is really him.
Okay.
So the hacker doesn't, even if he has my password, he also needs my phone.
Oh, okay. So that would give a little extra protection there.
Right. Now, admittedly, it can be kind of a pain. You got to commit to this one.
Right.
You know, like right now, I'm actually using your laptop,
right,
and I just had to do that. But I really feel like it's worth it.
Sure.
At least for me, knowing that one of my friends is probably out to kill me.
A little paranoid there. Yeah, Facebook does it too.
Yes,
I like
they
that.
Do.
It's a little bit simpler. What happens is when you log in, it asks you, okay, what's the name of this computer? Because you've never logged in from this computer before.
Mm-hmm.
And you put in a name, and then I get a text message right then and there that says, Brandon's laptop logged into your Facebook account.
Right, yeah.
And it sends you an email that says, okay, this is what you do if that wasn't supposed to happen.
Exactly.
So it's really helpful.
No, their way is very nice. I like that.
And when a few years ago, when I went to the Netherlands, actually that happened to my Facebook account. I got compromised while I was over there.
Oh, really?
And I did not get a message back then because I didn't have two-step authentication.
Compromised in Amsterdam.
Yes. So I had to get in there and reboot my system. And
wow.
Reset up all my passwords. So
yeah, and to be clear, two-factor authentication doesn't happen automatically. It is something you have to turn on
right.
These services. Usually, if you go into your account settings and click through to security, you'll see something about two-factor authentication or two-step verification.
Right,
I think Google calls it. Another service worth mentioning that just added this feature is Dropbox.
Dropbox, ooh, fantastic.
Yeah, we love Dropbox. Dropbox is the cloud sharing / backup. That a lot of people are using right now. And it has had some high-profile security breaches recently. So they are taking things seriously, and they have added just recently two-factor authentication for them. So again, if somebody logs into Dropbox from a computer you don't usually use, it'll send a message to your phone.
That's great, because that could cause a lot of problems if people are getting into your Dropbox account, too.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, yeah.
Well, another thing that we've talked about a bunch on this show, but it always is good to remind folks, is backing up your computer.
Backup.
Huge, important thing. There's a couple of them online. There's Mozy and Carbonite. Mozy's a nice, it's cheap. You can use it for free for 2 gigs,
wow,
unlimited.
Nice.
Or, well, too limited by 2 gigs, but you can use it forever.
2 gigs is a good amount.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it certainly doesn't
it's
cover
like
your whole computer.
Your movie collection,
right.
But it can get all your important documents.
Yeah. And also, for $5 a month, you can get it to back up your entire computer.
Well,
so
$5
that's
a
nice.
Month is like nothing.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Now, Carbonite is different. They don't have a free version, but it's $50 a year.
Okay.
And it backs up your entire computer. So if your computer crashes or the hackers take over your computer, you've got all
government.
Your data. Or the government or, you know, the mean corporations, you know. So you've got that information backed up, so okay. You don't lose it all.
Awesome.
Now, if you're really paranoid, as I'm starting to sense you are, there are some offline backups like SyncBack and CrashPlan are another couple of good options. CrashPlan you can actually also do online for a small fee. It's CrashPlan Plus. But if you have an external hard drive, you can use CrashPlan and just use it to back up your system.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and what's nice is the CrashPlan Plus, you can, for $10 a month, you can back up to 10 computers.
Wow.
So whereas Carbonite's $50 a year, you can only back up one computer. With this, you can actually back up to 10 computers. So
that's a really good deal.
It's not too bad. So let's see. And then there's SyncBack, which that you can only do locally. So
okay.
Yeah. So let's see.
Do you, so I guess that covers it, right?
That's pretty much it.
If you guys out there have a tip for securing your personal information, we would love to hear it. Give us a call, drop us an email, tell us what we missed.
And if you've got questions about anything that we just talked about, let us know that too.
All right. Speaking of questions, we have a reader that wrote us an email. Bob says, I'm looking at getting an iPhone 3GS because I found out I can get an unlocked one for $200. I wanted to make sure, though, can I use it on T-Mobile?
Well, you can, but honestly, I wouldn't. There's a couple of reasons. First of all, later this week, Apple is all but certainly going to be announcing the new iPhone, and I would bet a week's pay that they're going to be simultaneously dropping the iPhone 3GS and moving the iPhone 4 into its place for $0 on a 2-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you'll probably be able to pick up an unlocked 8-gig iPhone 4 for $200. The iPhone 4 is a substantially better than the iPhone 3GS. It's got the 5 megapixel camera on the back, the front-facing camera, the Retina display, and it also has a much faster processor. So all in all, it's just a much better phone.
So just wait 1 week.
Yeah. So
you can have a vastly improved phone.
Exactly.
For the same price.
All right. Well, we've got to take a break. And when we come back, we've got this week's big tech stories plus more of your questions. You're listening to Deemable Tech. If you missed an episode of Deemable Tech, or you just want to hear the show again, be sure to subscribe to our podcast by searching for Deemable Tech in your favorite podcast app, like iTunes or Google Listen. If Deemable Tech isn't listed, you can type in our podcast URL, which is dmbl.co/pod. That's dmbl.co/pod. Also, be sure to follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/deemable, or on Twitter at deemable. You can also find us on Google+. Just search for Deemable Tech.
Welcome back to Deemable Tech. Before we jump into your questions, let's take a look at the news feed.
Well, in case you missed it, last week was apparently National Tech Announcement Week.
I didn't hear about that.
There was just a tech news throwdown.
Nice.
Nokia and Microsoft unveiled two new Windows 8 smartphones, and Amazon revealed its next generation of Kindle e-readers and Kindle Fire tablets.
Yeah, it looks like Amazon is getting into tablets in a big way. Now, they already had the 7-inch Kindle Fire, of course, that came out last year.
Yeah, that one was cool.
Yeah. But that was their only real tablet. Now they have an upgraded 7-inch Fire, and they have a new 7-inch Fire HD.
Ooh, it's HD.
But wait, there's more.
Ooh.
Amazon is actually going head-to-head with the iPad with an 8.9-inch Kindle Fire HD.
That's not head-to-head. That's like head-to-neck.
All right. Head-to-neck. But they're getting up there. The thing is, the price point's only $299.
That's nice.
Yeah. They're also selling a 4G model for $499. And ooh. To me, Amazon is clearly building on their business model of outselling their competitors by underpricing them. Because their 8.9-inch high-def tablet for less than $300, I'm impressed. The 4G model is pricier, but it has a little discount of its own. For $50 a year, subscribers can get 250 megabytes of data per month. And you'd be hard-pressed to find a data plan cheaper than that.
$50 a year.
A year.
Not a month.
Not a month. A year.
Okay, but 250 megs of data, that's not a lot.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
but it's 4G.
That's true. So you definitely wouldn't be watching a movie on this.
No. And there's rumors that they're going to have other plans, and I believe it's going to be running over AT&T, but that hasn't necessarily been officially announced.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So the original Fire has been upgraded, and they reduced the price of that one as well, right?
Yes. Yes, okay, they have.
Yeah, wow.
They haven't forgotten their e-readers either. The Kindle Touch is getting a serious upgrade. The next model will feature a technology they're calling PageBright, which allows for a brighter background with a higher contrast ink. Oh, and there's built-in front lighting. I love my old school Kindle Touch, but it's feeling just a tad jealous right now.
Yeah, and that's a big difference for some of our listeners who might not know. Most screens are backlit, which means the lights are shining in your eyeballs.
Right.
With this, it's actually front lit, so the light is coming from the front of your screen to the
right,
text.
Right, shining down onto the page.
I know,
just
and that
like
is
a book?
It's really impressive. Just like, yeah, when you're reading a book, the light's coming and shining, reflecting off of the screen. So it's a lot nicer on the eyes.
Okay, so who else had announcements this week?
Well, meanwhile, while Kindle was doing their thing, Nokia and Microsoft did a joint unveiling of the new flagship for the Windows Phone 8, the Nokia Lumia 920.
Okay.
The eye-catching, it was very colorful, smartphone, will run the brand new, completely overhauled version of Windows Phone operating system. And Nokia is toting a sophisticated camera as its killer feature. Something called floating lens technology allows the phone to take much more stable video than, say, you know, an iPhone 4S like I have. And the same technology also allows for better photos in low light conditions, which is something that always frustrates everyone who owns a smartphone. You just can't take a good picture in low lights. But Nokia also announced the Lumia's 920's little brother, the 820, with similar technology but a lower price point. So nice new phones.
Now, there were a couple of snafus with each launch.
Yes, there were.
If you're wondering how Amazon keeps those prices so low, well, there is a catch. Remember how the old Kindle Touch cost $139, but you can get an ad-supported version for $99?
Right.
Okay. Well, all the new Kindle tablets are ad-supported.
Ooh.
All of them, 100%. The Fires, the HD, the whatever. They're all ad-supported.
Okay. So you can't opt out of it at purchase? You can't get the more expensive version?
Initially, they basically said no. Now, there's been quite a bit of an uproar over this, and there looks like they're starting to backpedal. In a statement to The Verge, Amazon has now said that it will add an option to allow users to opt out of the ads for an extra $15. How and when this feature will appear or be implemented is unknown.
Interesting. Because, yeah, they made an official statement saying, no, you can't opt out of it. You're going to get ads whether you like it or not.
Yeah. And basically, they said, people love our ads so much. Nobody would want a non-ad phone or a non-ad tablet.
Right. Of course not. Except that they would.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't
exactly.
like ads.
I mean, so. Just give us the option, man.
Well, meanwhile, remember that awesome camera on the Nokia Lumia 920 we were talking
about?
Yeah,
that sounds so cool.
Well, at the unveiling, they showed several demos of side-by-side comparisons of other camera phones. And the demo of the video stabilization feature made the video just look smooth as silk. And their sample night shots were incredibly bright and detailed. Like, I've never seen a photo like that.
I know.
That wasn't on a really expensive high-end camera with great lighting.
It looked professional quality.
And ironically, there's a good reason for that. Here's the problem. The video demo and at least some of the night shots were definitely faked.
Oh my gosh.
That's right. Some eagle-eyed blogger spotted a cameraman in the video with a full camera stabilization rig holding a video camera in the reflection of a van window in the video demo.
Oops.
And it was obviously a high-end camera. And then when the night shots were called into question, especially after someone produced a picture of the photo shoot that showed studio lights and a professional digital camera.
Oh, come on, Nokia.
So, huge mistake on their part. I mean, and when I saw these pictures, I was just flabbergasted.
Yeah.
They looked gorgeous.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't believe that a smartphone had created
pictures this great. And apparently a smartphone didn't.
And yeah, that's why. So, Nokia's response to this is that the demos represented what the camera phone will be able to do when it's released.
Mm-hmm.
And since they didn't announce an official release date, which I ranted on our website.
That's right.
I suppose they've got plenty of time to work out the kinks because they can take all the time they need. Perhaps when they actually launch it, it will be a professional camera.
That's right.
Well, with a full studio lighting set.
Yeah, who knows? But the next company with a big announcement is a little outfit you may have heard of called Apple.
That's right. They've got something.
So the rumors are swirling around, but we are pretty sure that on September 12th, they're going to unveil the very long-awaited iPhone 5.
Yeah, it was cute, the announcement they sent out. It was it's finally coming, and it was a 12 for September 12th, but in the shadow, there was a 5.
Nice.
And they've never really done that before, where they just were blatantly like, our next product is going to be called this.
Yeah, they were probably just afraid people were going to be like, maybe it's just going to be the 4T.
The 4GS.
The 4GS.
Which, I mean, they could.
They could.
It's probably going to have 4G in it. Mm-hmm. So they could actually call it the iPhone 4G and make people even more confused. Or just call it the new iPhone.
Yeah.
The new iPhone.
That's true. That's what they did with the iPad.
That's true. They could do that. Well, let's see. We got some questions. Let's take a look at those real quick.
Great.
We got Mitch from Miami writes, I've been reading alarming news reports about hackers using Java to take over people's computers. He sounds paranoid like you.
Mm.
Maybe. They recommend disabling Java immediately. Do I have Java? And if I do, how do I disable it? Java with coffee.
No. Actually, that's a good point. This is not paranoia. We've actually also been hearing some scary stuff about Java too, Mitch. For once, it seems this is not a scam or a hoax. It's a real threat. But before we talk about what you can do about it, let me give you an idea of what Java is. So basically, Java is a programming language. Came out 20 years ago, and it's designed so that programs written in it can be run on any computer operating system, PC or Mac or Linux or whatever. Nowadays, we really take for granted that the web works the same way on any kind of computer or phone or tablet. But when the web first came out, this was a new idea, and there weren't too many technologies that allowed you to write one program that would run on any computer. But there was one language that can do that, and that was Java.
Right.
So people would write little programs called Java applets and embed them in web pages. And
like the games.
Yeah.
There were a lot of games.
That was a major use for it. It just allowed you to do kind of more than a normal web page could do by itself at the time. Of course, this basically meant that you were allowing a web page to download a program to your computer and run it, but it was the 90s. What did we know? Anyways, flash forward 15 years and web technology's come a long, long way. Websites are basically applications now that run on your browser, and they're pretty powerful in their own right. They don't really need Java. What has Java done for you lately? Probably not a whole heck of a lot, except possibly cause you to get hacked. Back in March, Java caused big problems for Mac users with an infection called Flashback that basically allowed hackers to take over their machines wholesale.
I remember hearing about that Mac users were having issues with that.
And it was widespread.
Okay, so it didn't really just affect Mac users.
PC users. The great thing about Java is that it's designed to work on any computer, so I guess the security holes apply to any computer.
Wow, I did not know about this.
So PC users aren't necessarily any safer running Java. The problem basically is that over the past couple years, hackers have uncovered a number of security holes in Java applets that allow them to do all kinds of bad things to your computer. And worse still, these loopholes were undetected and unpatched until very recently.
Wow.
Now, a security loophole for which there is no fix is known as a zero-day exploit in the industry. And researchers have recently identified a couple of these zero-day exploits in Java, and they've been out there around long enough that they are actually integrated into standard issue hacking kits that you can just download.
Okay, so what's a standard issue hacking kit?
You know, it's
like when you join the hacking army.
Yeah, basically, like you're some 16-year-old and you want to try hacking computers. You just go to a website. You don't know anything, but you download like a set of tools, and one of those tools would probably be something to exploit Java's zero-day exploits.
Wow.
Yeah. It would be right there, and you wouldn't have to know a thing. You'd probably just run a program, and it would be, okay, what computer do you want to target?
So it's like downloading shareware.
Yeah.
Or freeware.
I mean, it's fire and forget.
Wow. That is really bad.
It's really bad.
What can we do about it?
Good question. The company owns Java is Oracle, and obviously they've not been on the ball fixing this stuff, but as of August 30th, Oracle has finally released a patch for Java that closes the known loopholes. So you could just go ahead and make sure that you are patched up to the latest version of Java. You can just go to www.java.com and download it.
Okay.
But obviously at this point, there's people who are pretty skeptical about Oracle's continued ability to protect its users.
I mean, I'm becoming one of them.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Java just isn't that useful anymore.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't remember the last time that I use a site that had Java on it.
Yeah, it's really becoming rare. So most users, I would say, could disable Java and never notice the difference while they surf the web. So Mitch, I'm going to go ahead and say, yes, you should disable Java. And let me walk you through how. How you do it is going to depend on what browser you're using. Most of them make it pretty easy. If you have Safari, you're just going to click on Safari in the main menu bar, then click Preferences, and then click on the Security tab. And there should be an option right there that says Enable Java. Just uncheck it. So okay. Very simple.
That's Safari on Mac and web, Windows. They work the same way.
They should work the same,
okay.
Yeah.
Good.
If you're using Firefox, it's treated as an add-on or an extension. So you need to go to Tools from the top menu, and then click on Add-ons. And you'll see a big list of whatever Firefox plugins you have. And just click the Disable button next to anything that says Java on it.
That makes sense.
Chrome works very similarly. You click on the wrench icon at the top of your browser, and then you select Tools, and then click on Extensions. And like Firefox, you'll see a list of these plugins. And again, you can disable anything that says Java.
Okay. What about Internet Explorer?
Internet Explorer. Unfortunately,
that's what everybody else uses.
Right. This is where it gets tricky because Internet Explorer varies hugely from version to version. Some versions allow you to disable or enable Java through Internet Options, which you can find under the Tools menu. It's usually buried somewhere under the Advanced tab. Or it might be, in more recent versions, an add-on similar to Firefox and Chrome, which you need to find under the Programs tab. So good luck.
Excellent.
Honestly, your best bet is to uninstall it from your computer entirely. And you can do that in Windows by opening up your control panel, finding Uninstall Program, and then scrolling down through the list of programs until you find the ones that say Java. You might have one or two versions on your computer. That's okay. Just uninstall both.
Okay.
Now, Java does have other uses besides the web. So there's a little asterisk when I say that. It's possible, especially for work purposes, you might need Java in order to run some program. If that is the case, you know, you probably need to get with your IT guy at work, talk about taking a look at that and seeing if he can disable it for you without uninstalling it entirely.
Yeah, because you might actually have some applications at your job
right.
That are built on Java.
Yeah, Java's not just for the web. It's a programming yeah. language and programs run on it.
Harass your IT guy to build something off of Java.
Yeah.
Or not use Java anymore.
Exactly. Or, of course, again, you could trust that Oracle will get it right in the future and download the most recent version.
Sure. Now, is this the same as JavaScript?
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah, there is another web technology called JavaScript. And despite the name, mm-hmm. it is not the same thing as Java, and you really, really need it.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's a really unfortunate name because it's completely different. Java was created by different people. JavaScript is not owned by Oracle or really by anyone. Basically, when it got named, they named it JavaScript to cash in on the popularity of Java back when Java was the cutting edge technology.
Excellent.
If you disable JavaScript on your browser, you will break about half the web.
Yeah, it's pretty much.
It's very important to have. And JavaScript is, again, unlike Java, it doesn't have any big zero-day exploits that anyone has discovered and is widely considered safe.
Yeah.
So disable Java, not JavaScript. Got it?
Yep, I got it. Okay.
Okay, we'll post some links in the show notes walking you through what we just described.
Awesome. Well, let's see. We got another email from Joseph. He said, my dad taught me to always keep the boxes from everything you buy for at least a year in case you have to take it back to the store.
Oh, yeah.
However, I live in a small house, and my wife is about to kill me because I like to buy my toys. Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, 55-inch Samsung LED 1080p, two new MacBook Pros.
Mm.
Ooh, and my toys have big boxes that are taking up all the storage in our only closet left. So my question is, can I get rid of the boxes? If I have to take something back, are they going to need the box to replace or repair it, or will the receipt be enough?
Joseph, first of all, where do you live? Because we are coming over to play with your toys.
Yes, and could you have some nachos? I like the ones that are shaped like scoops. And queso. I like queso.
Scoop chips are awesome. Like, that's an amazing innovation.
Yeah. So.
Oh, right. The question.
Oh, right. Oh, sorry. We got distracted. Those are nice toys.
Toys.
Okay. Well, a lot of stores don't care anymore. As a matter of fact, I'd hazard to guess that most stores don't care anymore at all on big ticket items. If you're trying to get a refund, that's a different story. But if you're just bringing it in because it's broke, they usually don't care about the box. The only time where it might matter is if they have to ship it back to the manufacturer, and even then it probably won't be a big deal. I do the same thing. I hang on to every box until the expiration date expires, and I live in a small 950 square foot apartment, so I feel your pain. Well, if suffering through playing an Xbox 360 on a 55-inch LED 1080p television set counts as pain, I really don't know what that feels like, but I do know what it's like to live in a small place.
First world problems.
Yeah, exactly. So the compromise that my wife and I have made is that I must read the warranty as soon as I open the product, figure out what the expiration date of the warranty will be, and then put a post-it note on the box with the expiration date.
Oh, that's smart.
It works out. That way, when the date is expired, we can look at it and go, okay, let's decide if we're going to throw this away or not. Now, there are a couple of other things you should take into consideration before you throw the boxes away, though. Are you going to be moving soon? And are you planning on reselling that gadget soon?
Mm.
Those are two things you want to keep in mind. If either of those two are on the horizon, you might want to hang on to them a little bit longer. Because, for instance, if you got a big screen TV, it's wonderful just to throw it back in the box with the styrofoam packaging. Mm-hmm. And
I had a friend who just moved cross country. Yeah. He had the box for his 40-inch TV with all the styrofoam.
It makes life
just
a lot easier.
Just packed it right back in there, and it was, you know, completely safe, arrived intact.
Absolutely. Otherwise, just let the boxes go.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of them. You can always, you know, put them, or there's other option. You can always take those gadgets, put them back in the box, and send them to me. I will be glad to take care of them for you indefinitely.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
I try.
You're a generous man.
Let's see.
I think we got a quick question here about Twitter, or from Twitter, excuse me. From Twitter, at Joel D. Jones asks, is there a web-based podcast player you recommend for people who can't install software at work?
Oh, I'm in a similar situation. There are a couple of options I could recommend. One is Stitcher, which is at stitcher.com. They have a great, easy-to-use website, and they have apps that work on iOS, Android, and even webOS, so your account stays synced online. The downside is that Stitcher is that the podcast has to be in their directory in order for you to subscribe to it. Now, Deemable Tech is listed in Stitcher's directory, so if you're looking for us, you'll find us there.
Cool.
Another option to use is Google Reader. Google Reader wasn't designed to be a podcast catcher, so it's really Spartan. But it's a great RSS news reader, feed reader, which is all that a podcast is really anyways. It's
right.
A news feed that just happens to have an audio file attached to it. What's nice about Google Reader is you can subscribe to any podcast, but it doesn't have to be in a directory. So our directory feed address is deemable.com/podcast.
Okay.
Well, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we got more of your questions. This is...
Deemable Tech.
Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A. Edelson LLC, Simple Green Technology Consulting, on the web at aedelson.com, and by Jack's Computer Guys, providing desktop and laptop service for all of Northeast Florida, on the web at jackscomputerguys.com. If you have a tech question for Deemable Tech, give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or send us an email to questions@deemable.com. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. So on our last episode, we started a new segment we're calling Debunkable, where we take urban legends that have been forwarded to us via email or on Facebook and Twitter, and we do a little research and find out what the truth is.
It's like Mythbusters, but without all the explosions.
Right. So if you get an email forwarded to you or see something on Facebook and you want to know if it's true or fake, send it to us at debunkable@deemable.com. Now, hopefully a lot of these will be funny, because there are a lot of really goofy urban legends out there.
Definitely.
But this one this week is not one of them. This last week, I saw something in my Facebook timeline that several people had posted that caught my attention.
Oh, what was it?
Well, it was a picture of a sweet little baby girl that had been burnt in a fire.
What? Seriously? Okay, show me.
Oh
my gosh, that is horrifying.
Yeah, it's really bad. According to the picture, the little girl was in a hospital in Poland, but her parents couldn't afford to pay for the surgeries and rehab that the baby would need. And the picture also said that for each share in like, her parents will get 3 cents. Please help them and share or like this post. Now, what really made it worse was the caption on the picture that said, people will not share because they do not want their profile page as ugly as their hearts. This is love. Be bold.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And that was a part that really made me cringe. Sharing or liking something on Facebook isn't a true expression of bold love. It's a way to make yourself feel better for doing something. It's called slacktivism. I'll get back to that later. Now, I knew right off the bat that this was bull. But in spite of that, I looked into it. And indeed, there is a girl named Ola, which is a nickname for Alexandra in Polish. It's Ola Kuskma. I probably just butchered that name. I'm sorry. She's in Poland, and back in 2005, there was a terrible accident where she was badly burned. Fortunately, she did survive, but her injuries were as terrible as are described in the Facebook post.
Wow.
There was a story on a Polish television station back in 2005 about Ola, where the reporter did explain that her parents weren't able to afford to pay for the surgeries that she needed. And in that report, they did include the account number and the bank where viewers could make donations to help with their medical expenses. It was hard to read some of the websites because they're in Polish, and
yeah.
I can't read Polish.
Really?
No, I can't.
No,
I can barely read English. But from what I could gather, she does need more surgeries. And is actually going to have one done here in the States soon in Cincinnati, Ohio.
But, okay, this was 2005. Ola's not a baby anymore.
Right. That's where the truth stops, okay? Ola is over 7 years old now, and her family doesn't get a single penny from a share or a like of this picture on Facebook. And this actually started, and you know, because 2005, most people didn't have Facebook back then. This started as an email forward chain letter. And they don't get any money from that either.
No.
So if you get an email of this and it tells you to forward it and they get $3 for it, that's a lie too. So in researching this, the really hard part was reading what her father said about this that's been spread around. And reading what he said about the people who are spreading this lie on the internet was really hard. Now, I know Google Translate probably had a hard time with the phrase that he used. But it said on the website that he called them soulless hyenas.
Ow.
That were preying on tragedy. And remember, he's talking about the people who just shared this on Facebook or forwarded this email. So I want you to think about that for a minute. How would you feel if a tragic picture, I have a daughter, a tragic picture of your daughter was spread all over the internet? Now, here's the thing. The copy of the picture that I saw had over 7,000 comments and over 319,000 likes.
Jeez.
I don't even know how many shares it had, okay? And let me be clear. I don't think that the folks who shared or liked this picture are soulless hyenas. I think that the people who share or like this are probably well-intentioned, but a little misguided and naive. So yeah. That's what we're here for.
Exactly.
To help out with that. Now, this is a little something that I mentioned before called slacktivism.
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 What does that mean?
It is a portmanteau of the word slacker and activism. And if you don't know what portmanteau is, it's where you take two words and you mash them together.
Right, right.
So it's basically a slacktivist is someone who does something about a cause, generally forward a tweet, like or share a post on Facebook or forward an email, but it's usually the least possible thing they could do. And it usually has only a microscopic impact on the issue.
Sure.
If it has any impact at all. And the problem is that because they did something, they feel better about it, they feel like a good person, and they can put it out of their mind.
Yeah, I totally agree with this. Liking something on Facebook doesn't make you a hero. If you're really concerned about a cause, you got to do something. You
right.
got to get off the couch. At least donate yourself. Don't buy into any myth that says sharing or forwarding something is going to make some faceless corporation donate for you, because
right.
it's not.
And, you know, this myth or this urban legend has been going around all the way back to the chain mail days.
Yeah, in various forms. Not necessarily
mail.
This little girl,
right.
but, like, I've seen this all the time. Like, every time you forward this email, Microsoft will
$3. Is, yeah.
Yeah.
Microsoft does that.
Yeah. No, they don't.
And they always try to legitimize it by saying there's a special code in this email that lets Microsoft or AOL track it. No, there isn't. That's complete bogus. It's started by people who are just trying to gain a sense of fame from this. Mm-hmm. You know, they share this, and the more people see it, they get like a thrill out of it.
Right.
You know, and actually I saw on Facebook, this picture was in an album of a whole bunch of other viral pictures that had nothing to do with, you know, this girl or anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, share this and make people's day happy or whatever.
It didn't make my day happy.
Yeah, exactly. It was the same kind of thing. So now in this case, really no good can come from it because the parents aren't receiving anything and no one is even trying to share the information to get them financial help.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they kind of do have a financial need, this isn't helping them out at all. It's not raising awareness of this issue. Yeah. It's actually just, you know, making things more confused. Now, even now, me knowing the facts, I don't even feel comfortable giving out the bank information because I can't confirm without a doubt that the website is a legitimate site because I can't read Polish.
Yeah.
And there's been so many scams about this story. So it's possible that this could be another one.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like a legitimate site, but, and that's what bothered me about the guilt trip on this picture. People will not share because they do not want their profile page as ugly as their heart. Don't try to guilt me into being a slacktivist.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to use guilt to get me to do something good in the world, not just post a picture on my Facebook wall.
Absolutely.
So
use guilt for good.
Exactly. Now, Mashable actually did an article that got me thinking. Not all slacktivism is necessarily a bad thing.
Really?
Yeah. Well, let me clarify. This particular slacktivism is a bad thing.
Okay.
If you got this picture on your Facebook timeline, get it off. That's my opinion. Okay. So hate me, you know, send your hate mail. I'll give you my email later. But that's how I feel about it. But not all slacktivism is necessarily a bad thing. Actually, some facts from the Mashable article. Slacktivists are actually twice as likely to volunteer to support a cause, four times as likely to encourage others to sign a petition or contact a politician,
really,
and twice as likely to donate to a cause.
Nice.
So, yeah, okay. Maybe all slacktivists aren't terrible.
So the good intentions do eventually translate into...
Yeah, they often do translate into real action.
That's good.
Also, something that's unique to slacktivism is that slacktivists can... It's so hard to say that word over and over again. Slacktivists can build awareness of an issue overnight.
That's true.
And that would have taken days or months or even years to build awareness about a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't a new, this isn't the best example, but think of how long Joseph Kony had been in power in Uganda since 1987.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knew who he was until some guy made a video of him back in you know, this year in 2012.
Yeah, and people shared it like crazy and it went viral.
Exactly. Same thing with SOPA that happened with SOPA.
That's true. It went
all over the internet so fast. So the moral of the story is don't just do something that someone tells you because they try to make you feel guilty for not doing it. Take a second, do a little research first, and then again, don't. That way, you know, we can talk about it on our next debunkable.
Absolutely.
So, let's see. Now, we got some emails. Let's see, what do we got here? One from Leanne.
Uh-huh.
It says, I am recently single. My friends want me to try out this online dating thing, but I'm not sure about it. Is it safe? What sites do you recommend? Well, okay, you're going to have to answer this one, Tom, because I don't know anything about what the online dating world looks like these days. Back when I was dating online, it was still... I didn't date online, but back when I was dating, online dating was still the Wild Wild West stage, and it was pure chaos.
Oh, yeah. Online dating has definitely come a long way since then, Ray.
That's good to know.
It was once the domain of uber geeks too scared to leave their parents' basement, but really, it's mainstream now. Everybody is doing it. I'm not just saying that, like, everybody's doing it. Everybody's doing it. I have a number of happily married friends who were matched up through online dating services. And,
really?
I've even given it a try myself on occasion.
Okay, so how did that work for you?
Well, obviously, I'm not married, ladies. But, no, I didn't have any bad experiences or horror stories either.
Okay, that's good to know.
You know, I just, I eventually decided for personal reasons, it wasn't for me. But it was definitely an interesting experience. But like I said, you know, I never had to sneak out of a date through the bathroom window, and I haven't been chased by a crazed woman from the internet with an axe.
Nice.
So, you know, nothing went horribly wrong. I would say, you know, in general, it's a really good way to meet people that you might otherwise not run into. And as far as safety, I don't think it's more or less safe than any other form of dating. I mean, you got to be smart when you date. Obviously, you got to use your head. Don't let the strange guy you met take you to the abandoned strip mall in his car on your first date.
well, yeah, that would.
But that would be common sense whether you met him online, at a bar, or at church, right?
Yeah. Okay. True.
And the other thing is, I think the term online dating is kind of a misnomer. I've never been on a single online date. I've met people online and then had a date with them in real life.
I actually did have an online date with my wife Second Life. Yeah.
Okay.
It was really fun. We actually planned it. It was back when I was into Second Life a lot.
Okay.
I was like, come on, let's go on a date on Second Life.
I want to hear more of that story.
So we both logged into our avatars. go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. We'll come back to that.
Usually it doesn't actually mean an online date.
Right. I have never been on an online date. Yeah. So I always would just shoot for coffee. Basically, you know, I'd be like, all right, this person's profile sounds interesting. Let's see if I can get together with them for coffee. That was my whole modus operandi or whatever.
Okay.
And that's a great way to go, I think, because it's a public place. You can let a friend know where you're at and what you're doing so they can check on you. There was actually one time, true story, after a coffee date that went pretty well, where the girl I was meeting pulled out her phone and said, hey, I have to call my friend and let her know that you didn't turn me into a lampshade.
Turn you into a lampshade?
Yeah. You know, because I might be a serial killer.
Awesome. Okay. So... Oh, now I get it. Wow, that took me a second. Okay, so online dating basically is just another way to meet people, but how does it actually work?
That really depends on which website you go with. There are hundreds and probably thousands out there. In 2011, online dating was a $2 billion a year industry. There are online dating sites for Jewish people, Mormons, atheists, people who love dogs, you name it. But for the sake of time, I'm just going to talk about three of the big ones briefly.
Okay.
One that you may have heard of is Plenty of Fish. Plentyoffish.com or POF.com also.
Hmm.
They've gotten to be one of the most popular dating sites on the internet, probably because they are completely free. Where most dating sites have some sort of a secret sauce, you know, some sort of computerized matching algorithm that will supposedly help you find true love.
Okay.
Plentyoffish does not. You just register, you create a profile, and you start fishing, basically. The great thing about POF is, again, it's completely free and it's popular, which is important in an online dating site because you want, you know, a large pool of potential suitors, mates, dates to pick from.
So the name kind of makes sense then, Plenty of Fish.
Yeah, yeah.
It also, it's ironic that they don't have a matching software. It just...
Yeah, they pretty much just open it up to you. Like, you know,
good
go
luck.
Look at profiles, have fun. So it's kind of like fishing. Now, Plenty of Fish, I should say, does have a reputation as being kind of the wild, wild west of dating sites. I've definitely heard women complain, specifically, about the creepy messages they receive from guys. I've also heard them making fun of the desperate-sounding profiles that they stumble across.
Mm.
If this is your first time dipping your toe...
That's what I remember from online dating.
If this is your first time dipping your toe into online dating, you might hold off on Plenty of Fish. I'm not saying it's a bad site. I do know people who have found success there. But I think it helps if you have some online dating experience previously and that you've kind of developed a thicker skin because there's some creepers on there.
Okay.
So, okay, obviously we have to talk about eHarmony. You know, they have commercials that are a big deal and they've even been kind of controversial in their own way. eHarmony does have sort of their secret sauce. The new users who sign up on the site have to fill out a 17-page questionnaire, which supposedly then matches them along 29, quote-unquote, dimensions of compatibility, if you pass the questionnaire. And yes, you can fail it.
Wow. Have you failed it?
I have a story about that, and we can talk about that if we have some time at the end
okay.
of this. Anyways, if you pass the questionnaire and then you sign up, eHarmony is actually also one of the most expensive online dating sites. They are typically going to run you around $15 a month.
Wow.
But that might actually
That's more than Netflix.
Yeah. It might actually be a good thing, and I'll explain that in a moment.
Okay.
So anyways, you sign up. eHarmony uses some secret compatibility sauce to send you about 10 matches a day. And then they actually, communication with these matches is pretty strictly controlled at first. So you can kind of weed out the creepers early on.
Okay, so does their magical compatibility algorithm really work?
This is my opinion, but I don't think the compatibility algorithm actually does anything much at all.
Interesting.
I've discovered eHarmony pretty much will match you up with anyone in your specified region who meets your minimum required criteria.
Oh.
I've been matched with friends in real life who I know I'm not compatible with, so that was kind of awkward.
Oh. yeah, I can imagine that would be.
I was like, oh, hi. Yeah, we're not dating. But that said, I do think eHarmony is onto something here. And it's not because they have some special matching algorithm, but between their 17-page questionnaire, which you can actually fail, and the fact that you have to pay a pretty decent monthly fee, that automatically weeds out people who aren't pretty committed to the whole concept of meeting someone for real.
Right.
You know, that kind of is going to rule out the guys who are just looking for a cheap score. So if you are looking for a long-term relationship rather than just a date, I would say eHarmony is a good place to be. Most of the other people there that I've encountered seem to be looking for the same thing, you know, a long-term relationship. And it's one of the only dating sites on the internet that actually has more women than men on it.
So interesting.
I think that speaks well of it being women-friendly.
Yeah, absolutely.
One last slide I want to mention kind of takes the middle ground between eHarmony's pay-to-play lockdown algorithmic approach and Plenty of Fish's anything-goes mentality, and that's OkCupid. And also, I've actually been on it. It is free to sign up. And then you start answering questions, as many or as few as you like. And based on your answers to those questions, OkCupid recommends people who answered the questions similarly.
Hmm.
And then you can do searches where you can filter them out based on various criteria, like religion or political affiliation, whatever.
Okay.
There are also a lot of fun games and quizzes you can fill out, which you can also that can also tell you a lot about a person. And OkCupid kind of makes their money by having a premium version that you can pay a monthly fee for that adds more features. In my experience, OkCupid attracts a slightly geekier or artier type of online dater. So
probably why you like it.
That's probably why I like it. This is probably because of their official blog, which I love, where they actually crunch numbers from their user database to tell you all kinds of interesting stuff about who dates who, what kind of profiles get the most messages, and so on. It's pretty interesting reading. We will, I think, link to it in the show notes. Be warned, they do talk about sex.
Oh, okay.
On OkCupid, you are still completely free to open message people, though. So, ladies, be prepared for the creeper messages.
Oh, great.
From guys like Romeo Love for You.
All right. So, all in all,
I think online dating is just a modern variation on the big, wild adventure that is dating. It can be stressful, disheartening, confusing, or just plain creepy, but people stick it out because you never know. You might just meet the one.
Okay. Interesting. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for your emails and keep them coming. It's questions@deemable.com. And call us. Leave us a voicemail at 904-632-DEEM. That's 3336. Also, even if you don't have a question, call us and leave us a voicemail. Tell us your name, where you're calling from, and say you're listening to Deemable Tech. And then say something funny. Keep it, you know, unpolitical and family friendly, and we'll use the best ones on the show. Our producer is Sean Birch. I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And this is Deemable Tech. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A. Edelson LLC, Simple Green Technology Consulting, on the web at aedelson.com, and by Jack's Computer Guys, providing desktop and laptop service for all of Northeast Florida, on the web at jackscomputerguys.com.